You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on September 1st, 2012 on Monocle 24. The Stack is brought to you in association with J.Crew. A Japanese-style Bible reborn, two editors on their likes and dislikes in magazines, and who's up and who's down on the newsstand. All that and much more coming up today on Edition 1 of The Stack here on Monocle 24. Also ahead of The Stack, we'll head down to Melbourne to talk to the editor of The Monthly about the state of the magazine business in Australia.
People are going to be hungry for the same things that they've always been hungry for. Once all these little distractions and all the impulse media of Twitter and social media, etc., once that flows over us, I think people will still want something substantial to keep them going and to keep them informed.
And in Berlin, we'll visit the city's best magazine purveyor to find out how to seduce readers while they browse.
In the beginning, the idea was not doing a newspaper shop, so doing a bookshop for magazines. And in the end, we say, okay, we have to show the covers on the shelves because most of them, people don't know them, so they can't ask for it.
All that ahead on the launch edition of The Stack. Hello and welcome to Edition 1 of The Stack, a new addition to our weekend lineup here on Monocle 24. Every Saturday, we're going to sit down with editors and photographers, correspondents and creative directors to review the best in established weeklies and obscure journals, big city dailies, and one-off personal projects. Along the way, we'll talk to CEOs launching bold new publishing ventures, meet men and women running well-stocked kiosks, and keep an eye on the forces shaping the industry. Most of the time, we'll be broadcasting from the cozy surrounds of Studio One here in London, but we'll also be taking The Stack tour hubs around the world, so watch for us in Tokyo and Toronto, Hong Kong and New York in the months to come. Now, before we head to Berlin, it's time to meet our reviewers joining me around the table this week. Now, we thought we'd get two serious yet fresh-faced veterans to sit around the table today. Both have done serious tours in editorial trenches, know their way around a flat plan, and perhaps recall the golden age of style publishing in the late 80s and early 90s in London. Marion Hume's been the fashion editor of The Independent, has edited Australian Vogue, and now writes for the FT, the Australian Financial Review, The Gentlewoman, amongst others. I guess we can talk about those other titles as well. Did I miss any, Marion?
You've missed quite a few, but it would be a very long list.
Okay.
So let's go on.
We'll get back to those later. Also joining us around the table is a familiar name to anyone who wants to keep their eye on the magazine business. Jeremy Leslie is a designer, commentator, and founder of the influential website Mag Culture. Fortunately, he doesn't exclusively reside on screen. He's also designed the books We Love Magazines and We Make Magazines. Welcome.
Well, good to be here.
Did I miss anything there as well? Maybe we should probably just talk to both of you about current projects. Aside from, of course, constantly keeping an eye on newsstands and what's happening with grids, etc., what else are you working on, Jeremy?
I'm working on several projects at the moment. I'm across the iPad, web, as well as print, all editorially led projects. So one project in particular is a new web publishing venture called Aeon, which launches next month. So I've been helping them with their identity, but as well as consulting on various print projects.
Marion, we caught up earlier this week. I'm not sure if you're allowed to disclose the current project that you're working on, which slightly steps out of the editorial world, but at the same time, I think sort of clearly calls on your journalistic background as well.
I'd like to disclose, indeed. It's a project for the United Nations. We're the United Nations agency called the ITC, which we work in an amazing initiative to use fashion as a vehicle out of poverty in sub-Saharan Africa, which strangely does embrace some of my magazine and newspaper world skills. You know, there's a lot of communication. It's a very challenging project, very interesting project, and involves people like Vivian Westwood and Ilaria Venturini Fendi, the Australian designers Sassen Bide, Stella McCartney.
That's interesting. I mean, also from a journalistic perspective, do you feel there's also a re-education that has to go on? Because I can imagine probably in the days that you were sitting at The Independent, had you received a press release from a UN agency talking about projects, I think there's sometimes a series of prejudices that people have when they think about these types of initiatives. So maybe sort of, you know, your editorial eye, has that allowed you to also then get into journalists in a different way to make sure that, you know, they understand the mission and you break down those walls too?
I mean, naturally, that I have a big advantage communicating to other journalists on it, because I can call up people who I've worked with for years and say, you have to write about this. And if they aren't very interested, then I can, you know, bend their arms behind their backs and, you know, I can make sure it happens. So there is, of course, that advantage of, you know, having been a journalist for 25 plus years. But when you mentioned the word prejudice, I thought you were going to say the prejudice the other way, which is actually the prejudice of, say, companies and initiatives outside of fashion towards fashion, I wouldn't say I have ever faced prejudice, but there is that thing that even in, you know, newspapers where you and I first met, that, you know, when I was working on one national newspaper in the UK, my page was called, they'd go, what have you got for PYT? And, you know, I was like, what is PYT? Pretty young thing. And in Australia, where I've, you know, worked a lot in my career, it's the same. You know, what have you got for DSG? DSG, dead set glamour. It's like, actually, I cover one of the, you know, the biggest businesses on earth. And so going back to the United Nations, it's, I guess for years, the prejudice of our business, of the fashion business, is it's a silly business for silly women. Mm. And of course, there's nothing silly about it at all. And using fashion as a vehicle out of poverty, you would think, what possible connection can there be between people in slums who have absolutely nothing and Vivienne Westwood? I mean, how crazy to connect them. But it's actually the opposite of crazy. It makes an enormous amount of sense.
Right. Well, hopefully we'll be talking about that a little bit later in the program. You've both done your homework. You've got sizable stacks in front of you. I've brought some things into the mix today. And in the intro, we were talking about, you know, the heady sort of golden age of style publishing, at least as we recall it, probably end of 80s, early 90s. And I'm going to introduce a Japanese magazine to the mix a little bit later. But before that, we're going to go off to Berlin to one of my favorite magazine purveyors, Do You Read Me, to talk about their model for seducing readers and encouraging people to purchase.
I'm Jessica. I'm one of the co-owner of Do You Read Me. Do You Read Me is a magazine and bookshop, and we opened the shop 4 years ago now. And it's specialized in international magazines about architecture, photography, fashion, culture in general, and mixed this with some interesting books. So one of our best-selling magazines is Appartamento. It's from Spain and in Italy.
Can you show me?
It's an interior magazine. And as you can see on the shelves, we also have the back issues of Appartamento, because it's not only about what's going on at the moment, it's more about people and how they live, with interviews and photos from their apartments or houses or whatever. And we know also the people behind the magazine. It's interesting for us not only to sell the magazine, so to know a bit what's going on behind, who does the magazine, how it works for them, and things like this, and also to be a part between the readers and the magazine publishers.
There's a wide range of magazines. How do you, I mean, you display them so you can actually see all the magazines you have, but is there a secret behind the way you display them?
Not really a secret. In the beginning, the idea was not doing a newspaper shop, so doing a bookshop for magazines. And in the end, we say, okay, we have to show the covers on the shelves, because most of them, people don't know them, so they can't ask for it. And we have to show it, and we mix it between magazines who knows the people who knows them and maybe more niche magazines, because then if you see, okay, there is the Frieze, here is the art section, and then you can see, okay, there is this kind of magazines, but you also see maybe things you never heard about it and can check it. And we also want that people can read them, not the whole magazine please, but to check if it's the right one or not, and to have a look at it.
The secret behind do you read me, if I get it right, is that you just put things together that you normally not expect to be next to each other. A magazine, a very well-known magazine next to one nobody has ever heard of, a new one. Is that the secret of the shop?
One of the secrets, I think.
And the other ones you don't want to tell?
The co-owner of Do You Read Me, Mark Kiesling, is a designer, and he's doing the whole things. The shelves are from us, or from him. Some flyers or things like this we do is from him, and it's totally reduced, but it's good. And I think it's the mix, the shop, the interior, the selection. You need all of this.
You're in the gallery area at this moment. It turned out to be more or less of a gallery area. Is this a right spot for your shop?
Yeah, of course. But it's a gallery and a restaurant, Kiez, you call it in Germany. And it's not one of the typical areas for Berlin, like Hackische Höfe or Potsdamer Platz or things like this. It's a bit at the second street then, but most of the people, for example, know the KW. It's a gallery.
Kunstwerke.
And if they know those, they are in our streets, so it's good for us to be in this area. And, of course, you have people here around about who are interested in things like art and culture. And we also have some agencies here around about. They have their offices here. So I think it's one of the best places in Berlin. And as we think about it, it's also Mitte. You can go from everywhere to here.
And that was Do You Read Me shop manager Jessica Reitz talking to our correspondent Nikki Ertz in Berlin. Marion, you spend half the time in London and then half the time in Sydney, 6 months, 6 months?
Yeah. So doesn't that sound good?
It sounds very good. I hope you've got the seasons right. You do.
Of course.
Right. So you'd be boarding a plane any day now.
Not quite, actually. It's March. It's going to be March 2013 this time, slightly delayed this time.
Now, so before you get on a plane, if you could choose and heading in any direction, where do you like to where do you like to graze for your titles?
A place that I suppose is so unstylish that I find it fabulous. It's actually a newsagent on Kentish Town Road. Mm. So that's, you know, northwest London, very kind of gritty northwest West London. And it's I actually don't know the name of this newsagent because all of us locally who go there for Monocle, for The New Yorker, for Grazia, for every kind of magazine you can think of, we all call it Slumdog News Agent because it's run by the uncle of Dev from Slumdog Millionaire.
Really?
And when Skins first came out, he'd be, you know, you'd go into, I don't know, buy The Guardian, and he'd say, "Are you watching Skins?" And I was like, "No." But then, of course, when Slumdog Millionaire happened and now, you know, the great career of that young British actor, That's my news agent. So I get news agent and celebrity gossip straight
all
from the family.
Jeremy, where do you go if you could just choose one?
Well, it was great to hear Jess from Do You Read Me there, because that's in the last year or so I've been travelling quite a bit, and that is by far and away the best single store that I've found. I think the place I'd like to go is probably a place in my imagination which has exactly what you're talking about there, the combination of every magazine. So you can go in and buy the big mainstreams, but you'll find little zines and strange curiosities as well.
Mm. Does it slightly depress you both, spending time at airports? And, you know, we spend a lot of time on this whole notion of efficiency, though, at newsstands, that there's just no curiosity when you go to any of the big chains.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, talking about your favourite place, in a way, it's easier to discuss your least favourite place. And clearly,
exactly.
WH Smith has to be among those chains who are just, you know, just mechanising the whole system and removing choice and just, you know, presenting some very good magazines, but they're a limited range.
And I love that notion of how she was saying just that idea of the adjacency that just surprised me when I go to the newsstand, as opposed to, you know, feeding me everything in the exact same place in categories, you know, which, you know, are just simply too siloized sometimes as well.
Yeah, and also don't try and sell me a 2-for-1. You know, that's the thing with a magazine. It's about choice.
Come on, you want the smarties, don't you? It's like,
but this is the airport experience, isn't it?
But worse is the Eurostar, and the Eurostar has no excuse. I mean, the Eurostar is a relatively new building at St. Pancras, so why they didn't put a fantastic news agent in there, because they actually do have space.
Because when you get to the other end in Gerdenor, the relay there is actually not bad.
Yeah.
At the other side.
Yeah, it's good.
We are going to take a very short break. We'll be back in a moment. We'll dive into the stack. And you're listening to The Stack. It's just 1918. If you're listening in Melbourne, 1818 in Tokyo. It's 1018 here in London. Marion, I'm going to start with you. You've got a grab bag. It looks like you've been down to the printers with some fresh sheets off the presses and some other things. What do you want to talk about today?
Indeed, this is kind of a Good Morning Australia moment. And I know you're going later to someone in Australia, but half of my working life is there. And it so happens that this week, the Australian Financial Review magazine fashion issue, which we only do twice a year.
Right.
So this is not going to happen every week.
Right.
But it's always, of course, a thrill as a journalist to get the cover. And the cover of this week's magazine, or it's a monthly magazine that comes out with the Australian Financial Review newspaper, which for people here, it's kind of the FT of the Southern Hemisphere. And
this would kind of be the How to Spend It, in a way.
It's kind of the How to Spend It. I mean, it's not they're not exactly the same. It's more a combination, actually, of How to Spend It and the FT's magazine.
Mm.
So it has the fashion side, but it is definitely not the luxury package that How to Spend It is.
You could say there's more journalism.
Okay.
I said it for you.
Yes. I mean, for me, it is really a terrific place to work because... You know, the three of us here, Jeremy, I know that you go back to Blitz days and that actually dates us all, right? None of us in here is 20, let's say. And when I started writing, the big ambition was to do those 3,000 word pieces that I could see people doing. And over the years, those 3,000 word opportunities have disappeared, pretty much disappeared in fashion. The Australian Financial Review has gone the other way. And the pieces have got bigger and the sort of investigation you're allowed to do. And actually this current one, I think, is a very good example because the cover subject is Giorgio Armani.
Mm-hmm.
And Giorgio Armani is, of course, one of not just the fashion world, but the magazine world's biggest advertisers, very robust advertiser. But all of us, I'm sure, know that when companies, these big Italian companies, spend money with your magazine, they expect deference in return.
Mm.
And this article was really walking a tightrope because, Mr. Armani is 78. I went to the show he just did in Beijing.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that what journalists say over a very large drink after a show that finishes at midnight and what fashion journalists write when they're thinking about their advertisers, there can be a colossal chasm between those two. So this was a very delicate tightrope, piece of tightrope walking.
Mm.
And the wonderful thing about the Australian Financial Review is the team there. I really always feel there, and it's, again, something that's kind of disappearing elsewhere in my life. I feel that I'm up on the tightrope. Trying the best I can to balance, but I have an amazing safety net beneath me of an editor called Jenny Porter, who's actually one of the best editors I've ever worked for. And I'm not saying that because she's listening, because God knows what time it is in Australia. So it's great, and we get a very good response to it. So,
from a design point of view, it's interesting that. I mean, we could argue whether the FT was the home of the sort of large format, glossy weekend package. Do you think we're going to see more titles migrate that way? The South China Morning Post has also introduced something like this. You could say that the Wall Street Journal with WSJ was a bit of a latecomer to the party. Is that the weekend package of the future that you're just going to get more, whether it's going to be on a Friday or a Saturday or a Sunday?
Well, I think it goes all the way back to the original supplements from the 60s. They were vehicles for colour advertising, which is why, Armani is a business transaction fundamentally. But they've increasingly, newspapers are relying on these weekend packages because these are the ones that they can look, I think, to a healthy future for. Mm. You know, the daily newspapers are selling less, but I can see a time when actually the magazine packages of the weekend are their primary print product.
Mm. It is remarkable when you talk to some of the big brands, and I always feel you can give them the most dazzling concept, you know, the all singing, all dancing, you know, film made by the best director for their website. But I always sort of feel in the course of that meeting that if suddenly the outside back cover came available or the opening spread, they would completely forget about the film. Yeah. And people still, and I mean, we've seen, you know, the ongoing sort of collapse of format of titles. And I, you know, I think brands still want to see mm-hmm. big format, don't they?
Yeah.
Sorry, Marianne.
Yeah, I mean, again, let's just come back to the magazine I've just written for this week. But it is big format, and we don't see that so much. Mm. And it's, you know, I mean, Jeremy, your view on this is far more informed than mine. But to my eyes, very well designed for the magazine that it is. You know, we have a great art director who's a joy to work with. Who, you know, Jeremy, you and I, when we met in reception here, and you said to me, oh, you know, I started with words and then I moved over into graphic design. I was like, I've only met one other art director like you. You know, every other art director I've worked with is like, oh, you know, no one cares about the words. Mm. You know, it doesn't even matter if you can't read the words. Mm. And you know, it's great when you work on titles when... Mm-hmm.
You, well, I do think that's changing. I think that's changing enormously. I think now we're entering a period where if you're going to make a print product magazine work in print, you need absolute reliance between art director and editor, and they need to be an absolute collaborative team with the responsibility across each other's disciplines.
Mm. We're going to come back to our table of magazines in a moment. We're also going to be discussing who's up and who's down on the newsstand with Jeremy Wright from the Audit Bureau of Circulation. The Stack is back in a moment.
J.Crew understands that tradition and modernity often lie hand in hand. That often means looking back in time for inspiration, pairing the integrity of traditional design with modern desires to fit and comfort. As head menswear designer Frank Mauchin says,
we're always inspired by art, architecture, nature, and we look at classic historical menswear, vintage army gear, and those were garments with integrity because they served a purpose. To us, J.Crew is about understated masculine elegance, and we're constantly tweaking proportions to keep the fit current and modern without being trendy, and so we're always moving. What makes it modern, I think, is the fabric and the fit. It's like modern traditionalism almost. You know, like the details are traditional, but then the fit, the fabric and the color, that's where you get all your updates.
J.Crew.
The September issue of Monocle is a global survey of flashpoints and fighting forces. In this inaugural defence-themed issue, our editors put on their flak jackets and pop on their helmets as they investigate everything from how to create a modern fighting force to how to design state-of-the-art camouflage. And we have lots more to offer too.
In the affairs section, we climb on board the USS George Washington to see why aircraft carriers still rule the waves. We head to Norway to visit the world's best officer training school. And I nip over to Brussels to interview Anders Fogh Rasmussen, Secretary General of NATO.
In the business section this month, we go inside the studios of America's leading camouflage designers. We take a look at the big businesses that have surprising defence interests. And we report on the major deals taking place at Farnborough this year. We also have our first Entrepreneur's Guide, a comprehensive look at how to set up shop. The battle-ready September issue of Monocle is on newsstands now and also available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Studio One here at Midori House. It is just 18:27. In Sapporo, it is 11:27 in Paris. Well, joining me in the studio, as you heard a little bit earlier, Marion Hume is here, and also Mag Culture founder Jeremy Leslie. And we also snuck someone else in around the table during the break. Jerry Wright is from the Audit Bureau of Circulation, the official watchdog of magazine sales and markets around the world. And he's here to tell us what's up, what's down, what's not working, what is. And I guess probably we should... just frame it slightly. Everyone, you know, not every magazine reports on a half-yearly basis. Many magazines do an annual report, some report twice a year, I guess, depends market by market. But it's always interesting, Jerry, to look at trends in the marketplace. And of course, the competition, the advertisers are always keen to see how many copies are given away for free, how many real sales are out there. What would you say, if you, and again, that we're talking to a global audience here, are there sort of three or four key findings out of maybe the most recent round in key markets that you found?
Well, Tyler, thanks for the invitation. I think certainly the UK market, which is the one that I know best in the first instance, I think there are a number of things we can see happening there. Sectors that are doing well, anything to do with current affairs, the economy, what's going on in the world. So you'll see titles like The Economist doing well, and The Economist doing well pretty much not just in the UK, but everywhere across the globe. Health, fitness, those sort of titles are doing particularly well. Areas that may be not as successful as they have been historically, certainly some of the celebrity type magazines. You can see that the intense competition there is not managing to sustain the sales across that sector. So certainly those are a couple of areas. But I guess probably the biggest trend across the world that you're seeing in all markets is the emergence of digital editions of magazines that are viewed on, you can be viewed on tablets, can be viewed on iPads, and can be viewed, you know, more or less wherever you are. And while print is still pretty buoyant, and particularly in markets in the sort of developing and emerging economies, print is still doing very well. In the more mature markets, there is a big move towards these digital versions.
I mean, Jeremy was touching a little bit earlier just on, where the daily newspaper, might end up. And maybe we've seen a lot of newspapers, of course, putting a focus on their weekend packages. When you also look at weekly magazines or monthlies, quarterlies, whatever, can you really see that also just from a frequency point of view that just, doesn't matter what your sector is, weeklies are getting a pounding, for example, or not necessarily?
No, I don't think it's. I don't think you can generalise like that, really. I say it really depends on more the sector that's up, that's down, rather than weeklies are doing badly and monthlies are doing better. I think it depends on the quality of the content, how it's put over, and how it's promoted.
I was going to say, Marion, your celebrity weekly feed, which I'm sure must be enormous. Has that been impacted by the likes of TMZ and things? Would you say, or do you still, if you venture into that territory, do you still think though that the weekly celebrity title, where it's ended up, is still relevant, or do people not like it because many would also argue it's become a bit of a culture of mean as well, and it's not just about reporting on people's nice homes. It's also looking at saggy bits and all kinds of other things.
I'm so over that culture of mean. I just I'm not interested. I mean, even of course there are celebrities that we all love or we hate, and I don't want to see that. But of course I'm fascinated by their lives in some ways, but it's a really difficult market, isn't it, that celebrity thing? Because if you're too mean, then it puts us off, but then if you're too nice, you become in style, and in style has that challenge. How can you be that nice all the time? You open it and you go, yeah, it's just going to be nice. So, but the TMZ reference, I think I'm probably the only person in Britain that didn't.
No, I'll join you alongside.
And it wasn't that I don't think strip billiards is, perhaps a very exciting game, but I guess I'm so print orientated that I waited to see that story in print. I didn't buy The Sun. I didn't buy The Sun. But had I been in my newsagent in Kentish Town, I would have looked at it.
For me, the issue with the celebrity market is just the novelty's worn off. I think it was very, very big, and now it's contracting, and it's a logical change. You're absolutely right. The balance between loving a celebrity and being mean to the celebrity is it comes and goes, and it's just faster and faster.
I mean, I think one of the other the factors is that is immediacy is really important when you're getting celebrity news. And if you have to wait a week to get it in a magazine, frankly, you can go online. The world's biggest English language newspaper website, the Mail Online, has a constant stream of the celebrity stories down its side, and that seems to be no small you know, part of its appeal and its success. So I think it's not that people aren't interested anymore, but I think there's now so many more places where you can get that information more quickly. And many cases for free.
Mm. From the perspective of the ABC, how much do you also, or do you run a side business in terms of also consulting and even consoling publishers as well? Of course, you're there to sort of report on the hard facts. You've got the data, but I'm wondering also, is there a forum as well that you're also, you know, offering, you know, feedback, you know, trends that might be working in other markets, you know? And I think, you know, we would all sort of believe that the whole world is going to be off a tablet if we were to listen exclusively to the US media. But, you know, it's not the case if you look at Japan. It's not the case if you look at Germany. There are many other markets which do trend in a slightly different way, or the acceleration to digital is not as fast. So I'm wondering, you know, is there sort of this consulting and consultation side of the ABC in terms of where the market's going to go?
We're not profits, and we don't set ourselves up to be profits. We're a member organisation, and we serve both sides of the industry, both the people who are buying advertising and the people who are selling the ad space. So it's quite important, I think, that we maintain a fairly neutral profile when it comes to things like that. I mean, as it happens, we do have access to quite a lot of data from different markets around the world, and clearly we can make that data available to any of our members, be they buyers of advertising or sellers of advertising, who would be interested in that. But I think it's quite dangerous. You know, I'm not trying to set myself up as Claire Ender's Mark II. You know, I think she's got that pretty well taped.
I mean, Marion was talking earlier, and we touched on, you know, just the importance and the presence that, you know, that you know, an ad has, you know, in a big print format. And I'm wondering whether the notion of pay, not that you have to pay, you know, $20 or $30 for your magazine, but just the fact that there was a transaction, is that increasingly more valuable to advertisers? Because we can go to so many free sites, and we can see banners, and we can see nice ads. But, you know, there's probably an argument, is there not, that if you actually, I'm really engaged with Harper's or Vogue or Vanity Fair or The Economist, I'm likely to be a patron of that brand because I actually actively went and paid for that title.
Yeah. I think I think broadly that's true, and I think what media buyers often look for within an ABC number, they look at the total circulation, of course they do, but then they look very quickly at what they call the actively purchased, i.e. the percentage of that total where people have paid, you know, good money and put it on the table. Certainly, I think, you know, for a number of media buyers, they would regard that as the most important aspect of a title circulation. Having said that, there are also some extremely good examples of where, if you can get high quality content in a free publication, that can also be very valuable to media buyers and advertisers. And probably in the UK market, you know, we've good examples of Stylist and Shortlist, which have done extremely well in the magazine market, I think, and have established themselves as credible editorial propositions.
Yeah, and for those listeners who aren't familiar, these are titles, you know, often seen at the boarding ramps for aircraft. At least that's where I see them the most. And these are newsprint quality magazines in a way, in a tabloid format, but given away free.
But I think, is no question, if you talk to a media buyer, you know, they will weight a copy that's been paid for, probably more highly than a copy that's been given away. But I think it's not to say that those other titles don't have a value on you know, when you're looking to put together a schedule of buying advertising space.
Jeremy, there's also a lot of magazines which are not audited. In the intro, Marion, we reference, let's say, The Gentlewoman. Maybe it's going to be, you know, audited soon. But, you know, if you're a major brand, there's still magazines where you have to be, and it doesn't matter whether they sell 1,000 copies or they sell 1,000,000 copies.
Well, that's always been the case, and I mean, going back again to Blitz Face ID, when they were around, they relied on that as well. It was a vehicle one had to be seen in, and it's almost it's a matter of pride to be involved in certain magazines, and that remains the case with Gentlewoman, Fantastic Man, and a lot of the smaller independent magazines. It's not about the reach in numbers; it's about the reach in quality in terms of the influence of the magazine and the association with the brand.
Do you think it's even more so these days, Mary? Because we've seen this incredible surge of also so many niche titles now as well. And you know, I think one could argue there's even, you know, there's more style titles out there which are almost self-published in a way. And it's incredible to see, you know, the brands that go out and support them. Now, it's hard to say, are they spending, you know, 500 euros for a page or 1,000 Aussie dollars? You know, we don't know, but still brands want to be associated with them.
The way that you can see how they support them, and it's actually, Jerry, the opposite really of your world with data, this instinct of, we, you know, we're just about coming up to London Fashion Week next week and then Paris, and you can see the way people are seated, that magazines that I'm like, who buy, you know, how many copies do they sell? I'm now in like row 17, but if you look down to row one down there and the people lined up there, of course, many of them now bloggers, but those of whom are, you know, have a print title at all, will be print titles that in, you know, in our terms, sell very small numbers, but punch way above their weight.
Mm. Jerry, just before we go, I wanted to, you mentioned digital. I mean, you know, you've also come from a world of where it's looking at, you know, volumes of magazines and you know, returns, which are, you know, in printed format. Has counting digital copies, people downloading, you know, the iPad edition, does that prove an enormous challenge? I mean, even, I mean, just from a compliance point of view?
I think in principle, it ought to be even easier because, you know, if there's a digital, you know, acquisition trail, someone buys a magazine on, you know, online or through a digital publishing platform, then there should be a pretty clear trail. I think the challenge we've got at the moment is, whereas in the print side of the industry, people have, you know, have worked out over the last 100 years how to, you know, put in place information that can easily be checked by auditors like us. In the digital world, it's still very fresh, so I think there's a lot of finding out about how to do this going on. But in principle, you can actually get more information about not just whether a copy was sold or distributed, which of course you can in print, but in digital, you can see whether you sold the subscription. Then you can see whether each individual issue was downloaded. And in theory, you know, further down the line, I think, not for right now, but you can look at exactly which parts of the magazine were viewed and not viewed by how many people. So I think digital opens up a huge plethora of opportunities. But I think as yet, publishers, the intermediaries and ourselves are still working out how to capture all of that information.
And can you tell us about the rules that in terms of how exact a copy, the digital copy, has to be in terms of comparing it to the print edition? Because some magazines do quite different
routes.
That's
right. We basically, in the UK and in most markets around the world, ABCs that are involved in this are capturing, on the one hand, editions of a title that say are pretty close to the print. They're either an exact copy or they're, you know, near as damn it, the same thing. And you can count those. There are also these other publications which we in the UK call digital publications rather than a digital edition. And this digital publication doesn't have to have any kind of print parent at all. So it can be a separate edition completely. It can have completely different content. And again, you can still count and measure that and report its sales.
But so, am I right in thinking there's a percentage figure that defines it as a copy of the print magazine?
In the UK rules, specifically, it's got to have 95% of of the same material as the print. It can have up to 25% additional content that's not in the print. But certainly, what the media buyers have told us is, if they're effectively, you know, trying to buy the print edition and the digital edition almost as parallel, then they want to know that the one is more or less the same as the other, so they can check what they're getting. If, on the other hand, it's something completely different, that's fine. They just want to call it something different so that they, you know, they can then sort of evaluate it and look at it separately.
Great. Jerry Wright from the Audit Bureau of Circulation, we're going to let you get on with your Saturday. Thanks very much for that. Coming up on the program, we're going to be heading down to Melbourne in a moment to hear from the editor of The Monthly.
I was in far north Queensland, up in the tropics for a long time, and you'd walk into a news agent and you'd cast your eye over what's on the racks, and there'd be like three or four pig hunting magazines, you know, different titles about how to hunt a pig, how to knife one, how to hunt one with dogs, how to shoot one. We're talking serious niche publishing there. But somehow these all survived. I couldn't believe it. I mean, there was three or four then, and the last trip I made up to North Queensland, there they all still were. There was Bacon Busters and Bore It Up Here and whatever other pig hunting magazines there were. It seems to be vibrant.
More on pork publishing in a moment here on The Stack. You're listening to Monocle 24.
The designers at J. Crew are constantly experimenting with new styles, but it's their staples that they're most proud of. As head menswear designer Frank Mouchens explains, J. Crew's unique approach to tailored clothing led to the now iconic Ludlow suit, recognized for its superior construction and smart bespoke details.
I love it when people start to recognize garments by the way they are cut. It gives it its own personality, and I think that's what we're looking for. And for instance, the Ludlow jacket has a specific narrow lapel. It's narrow, but not too narrow. It has a really nice soft shoulder. It has a shoulder pad in it, but just ever so subtly. And I think there's the Ludlow jacket is so great. I think there's about 200 steps it takes to make a Ludlow jacket. People maybe sometimes don't realize what it takes to come to this kind of product.
J. Crew.
Welcome back to this premiere edition of The Stack here on Monocle 24, where it's time to turn our attention to one of the most magazine-hungry markets in the world, Australia. While we constantly hear that Aussies have a voracious appetite for print in all its forms, it hasn't been such a smooth ride for the news and current affairs sector. Newsstand said goodbye to their homegrown newsweekly The Bulletin in 2008, and the magazine sector in most corners has been ravaged by cuts. Nevertheless, it's still the world's fourth biggest English language market, and there's still plenty of innovation. One title we always pick up during our swings through Australia is the sparky and occasionally spiky The Monthly, a left of centre, smartly written monthly. For more on the state of publishing in the current affairs space in Australia, I'm joined by The Monthly's editor, John Van Tiggle. John, if we look at the state of journalism in print, everyone's, of course, read about what's been happening with infighting at Fairfax, I guess, which was also a former home to you for a while. And obviously a lot of question marks to the power of the weekend papers and where things go. And as I mentioned, in the intro as well, we saw the departure, almost 5 years ago now of The Bulletin. What is the appetite for news and current affairs, for news reviews of a homegrown nature in Australia right now? Because, of course, you get the import, you see The Economist, and of course, you've got Time coming in, etc. But when it comes to a homegrown voice, is it a pretty hard field to plow, or are you growing incrementally and really sort of defining a special Australian voice, you think?
I think we are. We're certainly bucking the trend. There's a couple of magazines bucking the trend. In terms of the appetite for serious reporting and serious writing, I think it's probably best gauged by the New Yorker rather than the other two magazines you mentioned, in the sense that I don't know what the circulation figures for them are in Australia, but certainly the interest is peaking in terms of the New Yorker. We just had them down, the so-called New Yorker Five, led by Henry Finder, their editorial director here in Melbourne for the Writers' Festival last week, to pretty much packed out salons. So there is interest in that, and we take heart from that, I think.
For those who are not familiar, John, with The Monthly, paint us an audio portrait. Where do you sit in the Australian market? Who's your reader, or who did you think your reader was, and how has the title evolved?
Well, The Reader, the monthly title is a curious one. It was always something that was in the mind of our publisher, Maury Schwartz. He just wanted to contribute something like this to Australian culture. And it, in the beginning, well, probably in the first six of its current 7 years, it had a subtitle saying it's an Australian, or it's a magazine of Australian politics, society and culture. I think in terms of what we want to do with it, it's very much a magazine that punches above its weight. We want to have influence in politics. We want to, be part of the agenda setting, which is hard to do for a monthly magazine, but we have been punching above our weight, that's for sure.
When you talk about punching above your weight, do you feel that maybe the title is also in lockstep with where Australia's current foreign policy is? We see something of a, you know, quite a serious spending increase on the defense side, you know, massive procurement programs, you know, and Australia really playing this super regional role in Asia Pacific. Do you think that the monthly then has space on Singapore newsstands, and that Australian voice within the Asia Pacific region, that it finds its way up to Bangkok and Hong Kong and the newsstands of Tokyo as well eventually?
I thought we would love that. I do think we're still
establishing ourselves. You said that in a very breathy way. We would love that.
Yeah, yeah, we would love that. Well, it's true. I mean, I feel like we're still at the start of something. With the monthly, it's a magazine that that is much loved by our readers, but it's still a case of trying to get it out there and making people aware of it, that there is this alternative to the weekend magazine market. That's, you know, the weekend magazines that are in the paper. You have the same sort of thing in England with The Guardian and in the Independent magazine, but we have that here too. But those weekend papers are really hurting right now. There's been a mass exodus this week of journalists, senior journalists, who've taken their redundancies from the Melbourne Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. There is an alternative. I mean, the readers are still hungry for quality journalism, and that's where we see our place, I think.
And that's one of the wonderful things about Australia. If you hit the right newsstand in the right city, there's a plethora of great print, and you can really see that there is this appetite, and even for newspapers. I just want to go back to, you know, you mentioned the Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, and of course you've got the Australian inequality space as well, and the Aussie Financial Review. Do you think that, I mean, aside from being at a tipping point right now, do you think there's going to be some right-thinking people who are going to look at these brands and say, especially when you look at just the power of the weekend newspapers in Australia, and someone's going to put these houses in order? Or do you feel it's a little bit late for the traditional weekend package in Australia?
Well, the people that are circling around the weekend newspapers aren't necessarily particularly the Fairfax ones, the Age and Sydney Morning Herald and the Australian Financial Review. The people that are circling around those papers are possibly not the kind of people we'd like to see get more closely involved with newspapers. We're talking about our huge miners. We're talking about our richest lady. You know, these are vast mining interests, and they have made it clear that they want the newspapers to reflect their interests. And at the moment, with the way things are going, those newspapers, their share prices, is, you know, they're collapsing at a rate of knots, and they're very, very vulnerable.
Mm. Sitting in Melbourne or sitting in Sydney, where is the gaze of the editor or the journalist right now? Because I think when sitting in Europe, you know, oftentimes, you know, right now in London, I feel that we're maybe entering a bit of an age of reason in print. You know, there's been this great rush to all things digital, and of course, media spend has gone in that direction. And I feel there's a bit of a settle down going on, that people feel that, yes, there is room for television and radio, and there's room for good magazines, and newspapers are still relevant, you know, at least as a weekend package. And there hasn't, you know, maybe that sort of that great rush to follow everything that's happening in Silicon Valley has slightly settled down. Where does Australia sit? Because, you know, it is really pulled oftentimes between New York, London, Los Angeles. Do you think there's sort of a balanced view about media in Australia?
I think, like you, it's coming. We might be lagging behind the kind of vibe you're describing there in England, but I think it is coming. I think there will be a rationalisation or people just sitting back and thinking, look, it's not the end of print. You know, we're going to be okay. And people are going to be hungry for the same things that they've always been hungry for. Once all these little distractions and all the impulse, you know, the impulse media of Twitter and social media, etc., once that flows over us, I think people will still want something substantial to keep them going and to keep them informed.
Tell me what a great month at the monthly looks like, from cover to, you know, one or two lead features, to as much as not just word on the page, but when you get just the right image, when you really sing, what does the mix feel like to you or look like to you?
Oh, I feel like we're still working towards that one, Tyler. I mean, I'm working on my eighth issue now, and it's and this one's going to sing. But I always think that they're all going to sing eventually. But a great issue would have one piece of long-form journalism where the journalist has gone out for a long time and he's covered all bases, and or he or she, and has really delved deep and has come back with a wonderful piece that's got colour and information and news influence in there. Another piece, another essay, we can't run too many, would be a policy essay, something that really sets the agenda in terms of Australian politics. And then a few counterintuitive pieces would be nice. You know, in any field like this, in the beginning we were very much perceived as a left of centre magazine, and that's fine. We can be a left of magazine slightly, but every now and then you just want to, as you described it before, you want to be a bit spiky. You want to give the readers a little bit of a tickle up.
There's been a great shakedown. We've seen that ACP is not the company that it was. Condé Nast has moved into other hands. Mm. Find that that's a glossy sector. So within the traditional magazine establishment, there's been a real upheaval, and good editors have left and new ones have come in, etc. But in parallel to that, what's been interesting with the rise of your title, there's a lot of very good, I would say almost homegrown, more niche publishing coming out of Australia. It's actually quite remarkable given the scale of the market. Do you think that's what the country becomes known for now, rather than it being in the hands of the major conglomerates?
Maybe it does. I mean, as I said to you before, I was in far north Queensland, up in the tropics for a long time, and you'd walk into a newsagent and you'd cast your eye over what's on the racks, and there'd be like three or four pig hunting magazines, different titles about how to hunt a pig, how to knife one, how to hunt one with dogs, how to shoot one. We're talking serious niche publishing there. But somehow these all survived. I couldn't believe it. I mean, there was three or four then, and the last trip I made up to North Queensland, there they all still were. There was Bacon Busters and Bore It Up Here and whatever other pig hunting magazines there were. It seems to be vibrant. It seems to be healthy at a certain level, at that niche level.
And I think also from even a newer generation now, because there's magazines like Frankie, and there's the likes of Collect coming out of Adelaide, and it's very interesting to see that young journalists, young editors also see room on the newsstand, and perhaps in the wake of the vacuum that's been left with certainly other titles just going more mass and in many ways. To domestic, I mean, you have a domestic agenda, but you're definitely sort of, casting your eye around the region as well.
Yes, that's right. But as you describe, I mean, Frankie is a wonderful success story, really, for publishing.
And we're hopefully going to be having a little bit more on them as well. And now you've very much sort of tweaked not just my interest, but I believe the interest of our producers as well on all of the pig hunting magazines of Queensland.
I'd love to see you get all the editors of those magazines on.
Hopefully, if we get the stack down to one of the states of Australia, we'll do that. John Van Tiglin, the editor of The Monthly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Tyler.
The stack is back right after this short break. Almost to the end of the program, and where it went, Maren. When you go to your newsstand in Sydney, do you find any of those pork hunting piggy magazines?
I'm going to be looking out for Bacon Busters. I was listening to that, thinking, there are all sorts of reasons why I'm so proud that I was able to take out Australian citizenship, and this has now added yet another one that in far north Queensland, up beyond the banana curtain, there are magazines that I have yet to discover, which I find very thrilling.
We barely got through everyone's stack here today, but I gave you a copy of Popeye, and it was just when we were talking about a little bit earlier, just about the golden age of style magazines in this country. This is a Japanese magazine, which is very much sort of aimed at it was part of that whole sort of face blitz generation, and they've it's very interesting to say they've reinvented themselves to go a bit older. And I just wanted your reflection on, I'll let you have a peek at Popeye magazine. What do you make of it, Jerry?
The Japanese market, so, I mean, Japanese magazines are so different to Western magazines that I almost sort of come to a halt as soon as I begin to look. I mean, not just because they operate differently physically, but because they're so much more catalogue-like in their approach. And it's not just a language thing. I think, a lot of magazines one looks at from other countries are the same structure and the same logic applies as they do to the UK magazines, but Japan is completely different, and I find it really hard I have favourites in terms of the images and what I'm looking at, the general subject matter, but I find them very hard to decipher the difference between different magazines.
Mm. I don't know if you managed to flip through Popeye or what you made of it, and that whole sort of, because we've seen a lot of Western magazines go the way of the catalogue. We had a lot of shopping magazines, and so many publishers today, also even trying to, capitalize on the whole e-commerce, they look at it, click, and then buy. Do you think that's a bit of a dangerous divide when you look at the editorial world? When are you selling to me? When are you not?
Well, through a Japanese magazine, I mean, I absolutely share with Jeremy that they're fascinating and perplexing to us, aren't they? Even the way in which we read them. And earlier on, when I was looking at this, there's of course I don't. I can't understand it, but suddenly there's Paul Smith doing some kind of goofy, jokey thing, and you think, wow, he so gets it. I must spend more time with Sir Paul, getting him to translate these magazines to me, because I realise that it's not just language. I don't get them, but I'm enjoying looking at them.
Before we go, because as I said, it's the hour is absolutely swept by. Three recommendations from your stack, Jeremy. What have you brought in?
Well, three quick recommendations I would make is, one is Monoculture, which I think I might have mentioned before, but there's a new issue. Each edition is dedicated to one creative person. In this case, it's a beautiful one about Martino Gamper, the furniture designer. Why not do a magazine about gardening and do
Wilder
it properly?
Is
Wilder,
so beautiful.
Wilder Quarterly is a beautiful magazine, much like Appartamento we heard earlier, but addressing gardening. And then the other end of the scale, I brought along the daily magazines from the Olympics, and they continue during the Paralympics, and they are just extraordinary examples of 24-hour turnaround magazines that really bring a whole event to life.
Mm. Marion?
Well, it's a very Australian theme today, but I brought along Australian Harper's Bazaar, because I'm very fascinated now that there's a new editor at Australian Vogue, there's a new editor at Australian Harper's Bazaar, and uniquely they're both two extremely talented young women who are navigating that tough, tough world of glossy magazines in 5-inch heels, but they're both very brainy girls. Mm. So Edwina McCann and Kelly Hush, I'm really tracking what they're doing. The other magazine, which is my favourite Eurostar pick always, is Challenge from Paris. I buy it, I mean, my French is terrible, but I buy it because I like to track how rich Bernard Arnault is.
Excellent. Wonderful. We have to leave it there. My guests today have been Marion Hume and Jeremy Leslie. Our producers, Don Trump and Adrian Craddock. Our studio manager is Jack Phillips. If you have any comments, please drop us a note at info@monocle.com. But it's goodbye from me. We're back again at 10 a.m. next Saturday. News is next right here on Monocle 24. Have a very, very good weekend. Goodbye.